Leviathan, Part 1, Man, by Thomas Hobbes. First published in 1651. This reading is based on a text of the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 10 and 11. Chapter 10. Power, Worth, Dignity, Honour, and Worthiness. In the broadest and most general sense, a man's power is his present means to obtain some future apparent good. Power is either original, natural, or instrumental. Natural, original, power is outstandingness in the faculties of body or mind, such as extraordinary strength, good looks, prudence, practical skill, eloquence, generosity, nobility. Instrumental powers are acquired through natural powers or through luck. They are means and instruments to acquire more, for example, riches, reputation, friends, and the secret working of God, which men call good luck. For power is like fame, in that it increases as it proceeds, or like the motion of falling heavy bodies, which go faster as they go further. The greatest of human powers is that possessed by one natural or civil person, that is, one human person or one person-like political entity, to whom most men have agreed to hand over their individual powers. It may be that this one person decides how the powers are to be exercised, as happens in a commonwealth, or it may depend on the wills of the individual men, as happens in a faction or an alliance of several factions. Therefore, to have servants is power, to have friends is power, for they are strengths united. Also wealth, joined with generosity, is power, because it procures friends and servants. Without generosity, not so, because in that case the friends and servants don't defend the rich man, but rather regard him as prey. A reputation for having power is power, because it attracts the adherence of people needing protection. So is a reputation for loving one's country, called popularity, for the same reason. Also, any quality at all that makes a man loved or feared by many people, or the mere reputation for having such a quality, is power, because it is a means to getting the assistance and service of many people. Success is power, because it gives one a reputation for wisdom or for good luck, and that leads to one's being feared or relied on. Amiability on the part of men already in power is increase of power, because it gains love. A reputation for prudence in the conduct of peace or war is power, because we are more willing to be governed by prudent men than by others. Noble rank is power, not everywhere, but only in commonwealths where high rank brings privileges, for it is the privileges that constitute the power. Eloquence is power, because it gives the appearance of prudence. Good looks are power, because they are a promise of good behaviour, which recommends a handsome man to the favour of women and strangers. The sciences are small power, because nobody is outstanding in his scientific knowledge and skill, so nobody is thought of in those terms. For science is something that nobody can recognise in someone else, unless he has a good deal of it himself. Indeed, few men have any scientific knowledge, and none have it about many things. Arts that are of public use, such as fortification and the construction of siege engines and other instruments of war, contribute to defence and to victory, so they are power. And though their true mother is a science, namely mathematics, they are brought into the light by the hand of the manufacturer, and so they are counted as his offspring by the common people for whom the midwife passes as the mother. The value or worth of a man is, like the value of anything, his price, that is to say, the amount that would be given for the use of his power. So it is not absolute but conditional, because it depends on someone else's need and judgment. An able leader of soldiers has a great price when war is present or imminent, but in peace, not so. A learned and uncorrupt judge is worth much in time of peace, but not so much in war. And with men, as with other things, It is not the seller, but the buyer, who fixes the price. A man may rate himself at the highest value he can, as most men do, but his true value is no more than others reckon it to be. Showing the value we set on one another is what is commonly called honouring and dishonouring. To value a man at a high rate is to honour him, at a low rate to dishonour him. But in this context, high and low are to be understood by comparison to the rate that each man sets on himself. The public worth of a man, which is the value set on him by the commonwealth, is what men commonly call dignity. And this value that the commonwealth assigns to him is shown by officers of command, judicature, or other public employment, or by names and titles introduced to mark out such value. To request someone for aid of any kind is to honour him, because it shows that we think he has power to help, and the more difficult the aid is, the greater the honour. To obey someone is to honour him, because no man obeys those who he thinks have no power to help or hurt him, and consequently to disobey is to dishonour. To give large gifts to a man is to honour him, because it is buying protection and acknowledging power. To give little gifts is to dishonour, because it is merely alms-giving, and signifies one's belief that the recipient needs small helps. To be diligent in promoting someone else's good, and also to flatter, is to honour him, as a sign that we seek his protection or aid. To neglect someone is to dishonour him. To give way to someone else, letting him go ahead of oneself in getting some advantage, is to honour him by acknowledging his greater power. To claim precedence for oneself is to dishonour the other man. To show any sign of love or fear towards someone else is to honour him, for loving and fearing are both valuing. To treat someone as negligible, or to love or fear him less than he expects, is to dishonour him by undervaluing him. To praise or magnify someone or call him happy is to honour him, because nothing but goodness, power, and happiness is valued. To revile, mock, or pity someone is to dishonour him. To speak to someone with consideration, to present oneself to him in a polite and humble fashion, is to honour him, because this shows fear of offending him. To speak to him rashly, or to do anything obscene, sloppy, or impertinent, is to dishonour him. To believe, trust, or rely on someone else is to honour him, by showing one's opinion of his virtue and power. To distrust or disbelieve is to dishonour. To take heed of a man's advice, or of what he says of any other kind, is to honour him, as a sign we think him wise, eloquent, or witty. To sleep or leave the room or talk oneself while he is speaking is to dishonour him. To conduct oneself towards someone in ways that he takes for signs of honour, or that the law or custom makes so, is to honour him, because in approving the honour done by others, one acknowledges the power that others acknowledge. To refuse to do those things is to dishonour. To agree with an opinion of someone else is to honour him, by signifying that you approve his judgment and wisdom. To dissent is dishonour, and to dissent in many things and scold a person for his errors is worse than mere dishonouring, for it is outright folly. To imitate is to honour, for it is to approve emphatically. You dishonour someone if you imitate his enemy. To honour those whom someone else honours is to honour him, by signifying your approval of his judgment. To honour his enemies is to dishonour him. To employ someone as an adviser, or as an agent in some difficult matter, is to honour, by signifying your opinion of his wisdom or other power. To deny employment in such cases to those who seek it is to dishonour them. All these ways of honouring are natural. They can occur outside commonwealths as well as within them. But in commonwealths, where whoever has or have the supreme authority can make anything he likes, or they like, count as a sign of honour, there are other honours. A sovereign honours a subject with any title, or office, or employment, or action that the sovereign himself has taken to be a sign of his wish to honour that subject. For civil honour, as distinct from natural honour, the source is the person of the commonwealth, and depends on the will of the sovereign.
so such honours are temporary. Examples of civil honours are magistracy, offices, titles, and in some places painted badges and coats of arms. Men honour people who have these, as having so many signs of favour in the Commonwealth, and this favour is power. Any possession, action, or quality that is evidence of power is honourable, and therefore to be honoured, loved, or feared by many people is honourable, as evidence of power. To be honoured by few or none is dishonourable. Dominance and victory are honourable, because they are acquired through power, and servitude, if arising from need or fear, is dishonourable. Lasting good fortune is honourable, as a sign of the favour of God. Ill fortune and losses are dishonourable. Riches are honourable, for they are power. Poverty is dishonourable. Magnanimity, liberality, hope, courage, and confidence are honourable, because they come from one's awareness of one's own power. Pusillanimity, meanness, fear, and distrust are dishonourable. Promptness in deciding what to do is honourable, as involving a disregard for small difficulties and dangers, and indecision is dishonourable, as a sign of caring too much about little obstacles and little advantages. For if a man weighs the pros and cons for as long as time permits, and still doesn't decide, the difference of weight can't be large. So in not deciding, he is overvaluing little things, which is pusillanimity. All actions and speeches that come or seem to come from much experience, science, discretion, or wit are honourable, for all these are powers. Actions or words that come from error, ignorance, or folly are dishonourable. Gravity, dignified heaviness of manner, is honourable when it seems to come from a mind employed on something else, because employment is a sign of power. But if it seems to come merely from a desire to appear grave, it is dishonourable, for the gravity in the former case is like the steadiness of a ship loaded with merchandise, but the latter is like the steadiness of a ship ballasted with sand and other trash. To be conspicuous, that is, to be known for wealth, office, great actions, or any outstanding good, is honourable, as a sign of the power for which one is conspicuous. On the other side, obscurity is dishonourable. To be descended from conspicuous parents is honourable, because then one has ancestors from whose friends one can more easily get help. On the other hand, to be descended from obscure parentage is dishonourable. Actions that are based on fairness and involve one in loss are honourable, as signs of magnanimity, for magnanimity is a sign of power. On the other side, craftiness, trickery, and neglect of fairness are dishonourable. To be covetous of great riches and ambitious for great honours are honourable, as signs of power to obtain riches and honours. To be covetous and ambitious for little gains or promotions is dishonourable. If an action is great and difficult, and consequently a sign of much power, its status as honourable isn't affected by whether it is just or unjust, for honour consists only in the belief in someone's power. So the ancient pagans didn't think they dishonoured the gods. Indeed, they thought they greatly honoured them, when they introduced gods into their poems as committing rapes, thefts, and other acts that were great but unjust or unclean. This went so far that nothing about Jupiter is so much celebrated as his adulteries, nor about Mercury as his frauds and thefts. In a hymn by Homer, the greatest praise of Mercury is that having been born in the morning, he had invented music at noon, and before night had stolen Apollo's cattle away from his herdsmen. Until great commonwealths were constituted, there was not thought to be any dishonour in being a pirate or a highway thief, these being regarded as lawful trades. Not only among the Greeks, but also among all other nations, as can be clearly seen in the histories of ancient times. And even today, in this part of the world, although private duels are unlawful, they are honourable, and will continue to be so until the time comes when shame goes to the man who challenges someone to a duel, and honour is given to the man who refuses the challenge. for duels are often effects of courage, and courage is always based on strength or skill, which are power. Though for the most part, duels are outcomes of rash talk, and of the fear of dishonour in one or both the combatants, who, hooked in by rashness, are driven to fight so as to avoid disgrace. Hereditary badges and coats of arms are honourable, if they carry any outstanding privileges with them, but not otherwise, for their power consists in such privileges, or in riches, or something of a kind that is equally honoured in men who don't have coats of arms or the like. This kind of honour has come from the ancient Germans, for no such thing has ever been known in places where German customs were unknown. Nor is it in use now in any place where the Germans haven't lived. When the ancient Greek commanders went to war, they had their shields painted with whatever pictures or patterns or mottos they pleased, because an unpainted shield was a sign of poverty, marking one as a common soldier, but they didn't pass them on to their descendants. The Romans did transmit to their descendants the marks of their families, but those marks were portraits of the Romans' ancestors, not their coats of arms. Among the people of Asia, Africa, and America, no such thing does or ever did exist. Only the Germans had that custom, and from them it has spread into England, France, Spain, and Italy, at times when great numbers of Germans aided the Romans, or when the Germans made their own conquests in these western parts of the world. Like all other countries, Germany started out divided among countless little lords or masters of families, continually at war with one another. Those masters or lords painted their armour or their coat with a picture of some animal or other thing, and also put some conspicuous mark on the crest of their helmets, doing this partly for ornament, but mainly so that their followers could recognise them when they were covered with armour. And this ornament of the arms and the crest was inherited by their children, going to the oldest son in its pure form, and to the others with some change approved by the herald. And the descendants of these lords constitute the great and ancient gentry, the people of good birth, who for the most part have on their coats of arms pictures of living creatures, noted for courage and ferocity, or of castles, battlements, belts, weapons, bars, palisades, and other warlike things, because in those times nothing was honoured but military prowess. Afterwards, not only kings, but also popular commonwealths, awarded badges, as encouragement, to those who went off to war, and, as reward, to those who returned from it. You could find all this confirmed in any ancient Greek or Latin histories that mentioned the German nation and its customs. Titles of honour, such as Duke, Count, Marquis, and Baron, are honourable, as signifying the value set on the person by the sovereign power of the Commonwealth. In earlier times, these were titles of office and of command, variously derived from the Romans, the Germans, and the French. In the course of time, because the power of certain men in England was inconvenient, the powers associated with these titles ceased, or were taken away, and in the end the titles were conferred on the rich, or on those who had deserved well, for no other reason than to make a distinction among the orders of citizens. And men were made dukes, counts, marquises, and barons of places where they owned nothing and had no authority, and other titles were also invented for the same purpose. Worthiness is something different from a man's worth or value, and also from his merit or desert. It consists in a specific power or ability, for whatever it is that he is said to be worthy of, this specific ability is usually called fitness or aptitude. The man is worthiest to be a commander, to be a judge, or to have any other responsibility, who is best equipped with the qualities required to do the job well. And he is worthiest of riches, who has the qualities required for using riches well. Someone may lack those qualities, yet be a worthy man, and valuable for something else. Again, a man may be worthy of riches, office, and employment, yet not have any right to have it before someone else, and therefore can't be said to merit or deserve it. For merit or desert presupposes a right,
and presupposes that the thing deserved is owing to the man because of a promise. I shall say more about this later, when I speak of contracts. Chapter 11. The Difference of Manners. By manners, I don't mean here decency of behaviour, how one man should greet another, or how a man should wash his mouth or pick his teeth in public, and other such points of minor morality, but rather the qualities of mankind that concern their living together in peace and unity. Moving in on this topic, we should bear in mind that happiness in this life does not consist in the calm of a satisfied mind. For there is no such ultimate aim, or greatest good, as is spoken of in the books of the old moral philosophers. A man can no more live when all his desires are at an end, than he can live when his senses and imaginations have come to a halt. Happiness is a continual progress of desires from one object to another, the attaining of one being merely the path to the next. This is because the object of man's desire is not to enjoy something only once, and for one instant of time, but to assure for ever the path of his future desire. That is why all men's voluntary actions and inclinations tend not only to procuring, but also to assuring a contented life, and they differ only over how to get it. Those differences arise partly from the fact that different men have different passions, and thus want and fear different things, and partly from differences in what they know or think, about which causes will produce the desired effect. So I give primacy, for a general inclination of all mankind, to a perpetual and restless desire for power after power, a desire that ceases only in death. The cause of this is not always that a man hopes for a more intense delight than he has already achieved, or that he can't be content with a moderate power. Often it is rather that a man cannot assure his present level of power, and of means for living well without acquiring more power. That is how it comes about that kings, whose power is greatest, direct their efforts to assuring it at home by laws, or abroad by wars. And when that is done, some new desire turns up. In some, a desire for fame from new conquests, in others, for ease and sensual pleasure. In yet others, for admiration or flattery for their excellence in some art or other ability of the mind. Competition for riches, honour, command, or any other power tends to produce quarrelling, enmity, and war, because one competitor's path to the achievement of his desire is to kill, subdue, outwit, or repel the other competitor. Here is a subtly disguised example of this. Competition for praise tends to produce reverence for antiquity, for in this context men are contending with the living, not with the dead. They are ascribing to the ancient dead more than their due, so that this will dim the glory of their living competitors. Desire for ease and sensual delight disposes men to obey a common power, because ease and sensuality lead a man to abandon the protection he might have hoped for from his own hard work, and so he seeks the protection of the common power. Fear of violent death and of wounds disposes men the same way, and for the same reason. On the other hand, men who are tough but in need, and not contented with their present condition, and also men who are ambitious for military command, are inclined to keep wars going, and to stir up trouble and sedition. For there is no military honour except through war, and the best hope of getting better cards is to reshuffle the deck. Desire for knowledge and for arts of peace inclines men to obey a common power, for that desire contains a desire for leisure, and consequently protection from some power other than their own. Desire for praise disposes men to praiseworthy actions, ones that will please the people whose judgment they value. Not other people, for when we have no regard for someone, we also have no regard for his praises. Desire for fame after death does the same. After death, there is no awareness of the praise given us on earth, such awareness being a joy that is either swallowed up in the unutterable joys of heaven, or extinguished in the extreme torments of hell. Still, such fame is not worthless to us, for men have a present delight in foreseeing such praise
and the benefit their posterity may get from it. They don't now see the praise or the benefit, but they imagine it, and anything that is a pleasure when perceived through the senses is also a pleasure in the imagination. To have received greater benefits than we have any hope of repaying from someone whom we think of as our equal disposes us to pretend that we love him, but really to hate him. This state of affairs puts a man into the situation of a desperate debtor who, choosing not to see his creditor, silently wishes he would go where the debtor would never see him again. For a benefit creates an obligation, which is servitude, and an obligation that can't be discharged is perpetual servitude, which is hateful if the other person is one's equal. But to have received benefits from someone whom we acknowledge as our superior inclines us to love him, because the obligation doesn't press us down any further, and cheerful acceptance of it, which men call gratitude, is an honour done to the benefactor that is generally understood to be repayment. Harming a man more than one can, or is willing to, make amends for, inclines one to hate the sufferer, for one must expect revenge or forgiveness, both which are hateful. Fear of oppression disposes a man to strike first, or to seek aid through society, for there is no other way for a man to secure his life and liberty. In a time of tumult and sedition, men who distrust their own subtlety are in better shape for victory than those who suppose themselves to be wise or crafty. For the latter love to consult, whereas the former, fearing to be outdone in any negotiations, prefer to strike first. And in sedition, where men are always in the vicinity of a battle, holding together and using all advantages of force is a better tactic than any that can come from subtlety of wit. Vainglorious men, who don't really think they are good for anything much, but who delight in pretending to themselves that they are gallant men, are inclined only to put on a show of strength and courage, but not actually to attempt anything requiring those virtues. Because when danger or difficulty appears, all they expect is that their inadequacy will be revealed. There are also vainglorious men of a different kind. They are ones whose estimate of their own adequacy is based on the flattery of other men, or on some past success of theirs, but who don't have any true knowledge of themselves that would justify confidence in their own future performances in difficulties. They are inclined to approach conflicts rashly, but when danger or difficulty come close, they withdraw if they can, not seeing any way of staying safe in the fight. They would rather risk their reputations, which may be rescued with an excuse, than risk their lives, for which no rescue is sufficient if they remain in the fight. Men with a strong opinion of their own wisdom in matters of government are inclined to be ambitious, because, they think, the honour of their wisdom is lost if they are not publicly employed as legislators or judges. That is why eloquent speakers are inclined to ambition, for eloquence appears to be wisdom, both to the speaker and to his listeners. Pusillanimity, pettiness of soul, makes men tend to be indecisive, so that they miss their best opportunities for action. When men have deliberated right up to the time when action must be taken, if it isn't obvious then what it would be best to do, this shows that there is no great difference between the case for acting in one way and the case for acting in the other, in which case it is pusillanimous to remain undecided and let the opportunity go by while one weighs up trifles. Frugality, although a virtue in poor men, makes a man unlikely to succeed in actions that require the strength of many men at once, for it weakens the efforts of the potential helpers, efforts that need to be nourished and kept strong by rewards. Eloquence, when used in flattery, inclines men to trust those who have it, because eloquence seems like wisdom, and flattery seems like goodwill. Add military reputation to the mix, and men are inclined to affiliate themselves with, and subject themselves to, a man who has this trio of characteristics. The first two have reassured them regarding danger from him. The third reassures them against danger from others if they are under his protection. Lack of science, that is, ignorance of causes, inclines a man to rely on the advice and authority of others. Indeed, it forces him to do this, for all men concerned with the truth, if they don't or can't rely on their own opinion, must rely on the opinion of someone else, whom they think to be wiser than themselves, and whom they see no reason to suspect of deceitfulness. Ignorance of the meanings of words, which is lack of understanding, inclines men to take on trust, not only the truth that they don't know, but also the errors, and, what's more, the nonsense of the people they trust, for neither error nor nonsense can be detected without a perfect understanding of words. That same lack of understanding brings it about that men give different names to one and the same thing, because of difference in their passions. For example, those who approve some opinion that isn't part of any official doctrine call it an opinion, while those who dislike it call it heresy, though really, heresy means the same as unofficial opinion, except for adding a suggestion of anger. It also comes about from that same lack of understanding that men have to think very hard to see how to distinguish one action of one multitude from many actions of many men. For example, distinguishing one action of all the senators of Rome in killing Catiline from the many actions of a number of senators in killing Caesar. That inclines men to view as the action of the people, with the action and the people each thought of as a single item, what is really a multitude of actions done by a multitude of men, perhaps led by the persuasion of one. Ignorance of the sources of right, equity, law, and justice, and of their fundamental nature, inclines a man to regulate his behaviour in terms of custom and example. So he thinks unjust whatever has customarily been punished, and thinks just anything for which he can find a previous example that was approved and not punished. It is only lawyers who use this false measure of justice. Instead of example, they use the barbarous term, precedent. This is to behave like little children who have no rule of good and bad manners except the correction received from their parents and teachers. The only difference is that children constantly obey their rule, whereas adults don't. Having grown up and become stubborn, they invoke reason against custom, and custom against reason, as it suits their purpose. They back away from custom when their interests require them to, and set themselves against reason whenever reason is against them, which is why there are perpetual disputes, on paper and on battlefields, about the doctrine of right and wrong. No such thing happens with the doctrine of lines and figures, because nobody has to fear that the truth in geometry will interfere with his ambition, profit, or lust. Consider the proposition that the three angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles. If this had conflicted with somebody's right to wield political power, or with interests of men who have such power, the threatened person would have done his best to suppress this proposition by having all books of geometry burned. Ignorance of distant causes inclines men to attribute all events to their immediate causes, because these are the only ones they perceive. That is how it comes about that in all nations, men who are aggrieved about paying taxes aim their anger at the tax collectors, and ally themselves with those who find fault with the government. And when they have gone too far in this, to have any hope of justification, they physically attack the supreme authority, because they are afraid of punishment or ashamed of being pardoned. Ignorance of natural causes tends to make a man so credulous that he often believes impossibilities. He can't detect the impossibility, because he doesn't know anything that shows it to be such. And because men love to be listened to, a credulous person is inclined to tell untruths, so that even when there is no malice, sheer ignorance can lead a man both to believe untruths and to tell them, and sometimes also to invent them. Anxiety regarding the future inclines men to investigate the causes of things, because knowledge of causes enables men to make a better job of managing the present to their best advantage. Curiosity, or love of the knowledge of causes, draws a man from consideration of the effect to seek the cause, and then for the cause of that cause, and so on, backwards, until finally he is forced to have the thought that there is some cause that had no previous cause, but is eternal. this being what men call God. So you can't conduct any deep investigation into natural causes without being inclined by it to believe there is one eternal God, though we can't express his nature in any idea in our mind. A man born blind, hearing men talk of warming themselves by the fire, and being brought to warm himself in the same way, can easily conceive and firmly believe that something is there that men call fire, and that causes the heat he feels. But he can't imagine what it is like visually, nor can he have an idea of it in his mind, like the idea that sighted people have. Well, similarly, the visible things of this world, and their admirable order, can lead one to be certain that there is a cause of them, which men call God, although one has no idea or image of God in one's mind. Even those who make little or no inquiry into the natural causes of things still have causal beliefs of a sort. Their ignorance of whether or not there is some power by which they can be helped or harmed generates fear, which inclines them to suppose, to dream up for themselves, various kinds of invisible powers, and to stand in awe of their own imaginations. In times of distress, they invoke these invisible powers for aid, and at times of unexpected good fortune, they give them thanks, thus making gods out of the creatures of their own imagination. In this way it has come about, through the endless variety of men's imaginations, that they have created in the world an endless variety of gods. This sphere of invisible things is the natural seed of what each person calls religion, speaking of his own version of it, or superstition, speaking of other versions of it. Of the many people who have been aware of this seed of religion, some have been inclined to nourish it, dress it up, and form it into laws, and to add to it further propositions about the causes of future events, propositions which they have invented, and which they have thought would help them to induce others to serve them. End of chapter 11.